Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I am an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we are excited to be hosting this FedSoc Forum called Labor Law Without a Labor Board. We're very pleased to welcome Alex McDonald and Benjamin Sachs as our excellent panelists for this discussion. Alex McDonald is the shareholder and co-chair of the Workplace Policy Institute, Littler Mendelson, PC. He advises employers on all aspects of the employment and labor landscape, focusing on emerging legislation and regulation. He has extensive experience advising businesses on worker classification, arbitration, the administrative and regulatory process, and the future of work. Benjamin Sachs is the Kestenbaum Professor of Law, and industry at Harvard Law School, and a leading expert in the field of labor law and labor relations. He is also a faculty director of the Center of Labor and a Just Economy. Professor Sachs teaches courses in labor law, employment law, and law and social change, and his writing focuses on union organizing and unions in American politics. And special thanks to our moderator, Roger Kane, who serves as Senior Labor and Employment Counsel for the HR Policy Association. Roger specializes in labor and employment, healthcare, collective bargaining, contract administration, and representation campaigns. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not of the Federalist Society. With that, Roger, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Sarah, and welcome everybody to today's webinar. Just a footnote at the beginning, please pardon my informal attire. I live in Southern California. It's 110 here today. The doors are open and I'm moving, so I don't have my traditional Federalist Society sport coat on, but I think I can do the moderating without the sport coat. At least I'll give it my best shot. So, Professor Sachs and Alex McDonald, thank you so much for joining today. I sit on the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society of Labor and Employment Group, along with Alex, and you're going to enjoy his very thoughtful comments. And we're just also delighted to have Professor Sachs, one of the outstanding teachers of labor law and employment law in the country, and one of the leading commentators in this field. So let's just get with it. I told a reporter yesterday in an interview that I thought the National Labor Relations Board was dead. And I believe that to be the case. In fact, I think the board's been dead for a long period of time, even prior to the Wilcox litigation. But we'll get back to that. We certainly have not had a quorum at the board now for a number of months because of the Wilcox litigation. So let's just start with the quorum issue, because that seems to be generating a lot of discussion about where the board is or is not. Professor Sachs, does the quorum issue factor into your thinking about the future of the board?
Absolutely. And, you know, there are many ways in which the lack of a quorum affects labor law. In a sense, the most obvious way is one that we're not really going to, I think, focus on much today, but it's worth saying. Without a quorum, the board can't decide cases, and the board is, in fact, not deciding cases. And so that obviously has repercussions for many areas of labor law. I think many of us expected to see a rapid fire reversal of some of the Biden era decisions, and we're not getting that, at least not yet, because there's no quorum and there's no cases getting decided. I think that our focus today will be on a slightly different angle or aspect of the quorum issue, which I'm happy to lay out in broad strokes, and then turn over to Alex, who's going to set some of the background for us. But the basic idea here is that the Supreme Court over the last several decades has constructed a preemption regime, that is to say, a regime of law according to which the federal statute chokes off what states and cities can do. The Supreme Court has created a regime of preemption law that's based almost entirely, not entirely, but almost entirely on deference to the board. So the Supreme Court has spoken of zones of preemption. And one of those zones, known as the Garmin zone, is a zone that the Supreme Court says is protected and reserved for NLRB jurisdiction. Or as the Supreme Court put it in the Garmin case itself, the unifying consideration of our decisions on preemption has been regard to the fact that Congress entrusted administration of the labor policy for the nation to a centralized administrative agency. So this is all to say that we have this really robust regime of preemption. Much of it is grounded in deference to the board. And now we have a board that, in Roger's words, is dead. And so what happens to the preemption rules built around deference to the board when the board is not functioning? And my thought on this has been that it's at least plausible to argue that the preemption rules are essentially suspended. That as long as the board is not functioning, we can't have an enforceable preemption regime based on deference to the administrative capacity of the board. That's the basic thought. There's a ton of complications and a ton of unanswered questions here. What constitutes incapacity of the board? What happens if quorum is restored? Are there other ways in which the board might be, to use Roger's words, dead, and so forth? But maybe it's best to turn it over to Alex. And Alex, you want to lay out some of the developments in the states that are relevant in this area?
Yeah, no, thank you, Professor Sachs. And I think it is worth taking a little bit of a step back to frame up why we're having this discussion now. I mean, beyond the Wilcox case, which Roger, you started out by mentioning, there's been some developments at the states that have really teed up the issue about how far Garmin preemption reaches, particularly when we don't have a quorum. And there's not a clear path to getting a quorum again, at least in the immediate future. I would actually describe the court's preemption doctrine in a little more generous terms than Professor Sachs did, than choking off states. So you got to remember, we start in 1935. Congress comes in, creates for the first time a national labor system with the Wagner Act. And one of the two main drivers, the purposes of the Wagner Act, was to prevent interstate labor disruptions. The idea was we have these giant strikes that are affecting commerce moving between states. We have things like the Pullman strike, which ended up being very violent. And so what we want is to create a national system with uniform rules across the country. And the only way we can really do that is have one national labor law and one agency that is assigned to administer this law. That's the Wagner Act, which becomes what we know as the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board. Building on that premise that we want to have a single system to manage interstate commerce and interstate labor relations, the court builds multiple preemption doctrines. And labor preemption doctrine is not the easiest thing to master. There are multiple doctrines nested within one another. Garmin is, which Professor Sachs referred to, is the most important one here. Garmin was a 1959 case. And what the court basically said was the NLRA assigns to the National Labor Relations Board's primary jurisdiction anything that is arguably protected or prohibited by federal labor law. That is, well, we need the board to weigh in first and decide whether the underlying conduct in this issue or in this case is protected or prohibited by labor law. That, you know, that doctrine can cut different ways depending on who controls the board. By and large, it has prevented states from passing more labor-friendly laws. That's typically where we see this this doctrine come up. It doesn't uniformly apply that way, but that is usually the context in which it comes up. The other thing to understand about the statutory structure is this three-member quorum requirement. Normally, the board, at least the board's full staffing, is, I hesitate to say normally, because often the board is missing one or two members. But on paper, the board has five presidentially appointed members. By tradition, these members are roughly balanced between the in party and the out party. Whoever has the White House usually has three members of their party versus two members of the other party. And that the statute requires at least three of those seats to be full before the board can really do anything, before it can exercise a statutory authority, which is, Professor Sachs mentioned too, includes resolving cases, unfair labor practice charges that are filed with the board, and certifying election results, resolving objections to elections is where this usually comes up. So we have a board that has been dropped down to two members now because the president removed Member Wilcox at the beginning of this year. That's a whole podcast to itself. But the status quo right now is that because of a decision the Supreme Court issued on the emergency docket, it appears unlikely that Member Wilcox will be back at work while her case proceeds. And we only have two members at present. We have Member Kaplan and Member Prouty. Member Kaplan's rolling off here, I believe, at the end of the summer. Member Prouty rolls off in 2026.
Alex Pardonfeder interrupting here. You're right. August 25 is when Chair Kaplan's term expires, which will leave us with one member of the board, David Prouty, a Democrat nominee, a conferee. I don't know, and I'm not a board historian, but I'm not certain this has ever happened in the history of the board where we have only one member serving and that one member is opposite of the party occupying the White House. And I'll get back to my prediction about the board, but I interrupted you. If you could just complete leveling the playing field here by taking us into what has happened at California's General Assembly and also New York, and then we'll pick it back up from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So given the status quo of the board, we have two members, the board can't exercise the statutory functions. What we've seen is multiple states stepping into what they perceive as the breach. There are three bills currently pending right now that to one degree or another would authorize a state agency to perform functions in industries and in professions that normally are subject to the jurisdiction of the board. It's kind of a mouthful, but we'll walk through them a little bit. California's bill, AB 288, is probably the most, I say probably, it is the most ambitious of the three. So we'll start there. That bill is premised on a couple of things. You read through the findings that as the bill currently exists right now, and the board's lack of a quorum is one of the issues driving this bill. But the other one is what legislators in California perceive as their duty, or at least their inherent power, to protect workers' constitutional rights in California, the way they frame this up. They frame it not just as a matter of labor law and preemption, but as civil rights. What the bill would actually do, like just mechanically, would allow a state agency called the PERB, the Public Employees Relations Board, to certify bargaining representatives, to decide unfair labor practice charges, use its own precedent in doing that, decide election objections. And it could even, you know, which is unusual for those of us who are more used to federal practice, it could order employers to submit to mediation for the purpose of negotiating a final collective bargaining agreement. That's normally stuff that the National Labor Relations Board does. But this bill would allow workers, certain workers would normally be covered by the NLRB, to file petitions and request relief from the board, or from the CURB in this case. That would include employees who lose coverage under the National Labor Relations Board, either because the board, this part is actually a little bit unclear, but it could be just because the board declines jurisdiction or is unable to assert jurisdiction. But anyone who loses coverage under the NLRA would be entitled to file one of the petition with her. It would also allow workers who lose access, and this is, I'm going to read the phrase because I'm frankly not entirely sure what this means, and I'm not sure the people who wrote it are entirely sure, but people who lose access to a quote, independent, effective, and functioning legitimate and expert NLRB because of a lack of a quorum. We could parse that out a little bit, but that's what the statute says. And then also it would allow workers who petition the board. So these are folks who actually have filed a ULP or filed an election petition with the board, and the board does not make any determination within 6 months. Those people would be able to go over to the PERB and file a second petition with the PERB and ask the PERB to weigh in on the issue. So it's transferring authority from a matter that is on its face subject to the NLRB's jurisdiction to a state agency. That's a pretty radical approach.
Alex, that's, I think, a very fair explanation. Before we get to New York and other states, Professor Sachs, what's your take on the California initiative? Not surprising, maybe, coming from California, but what's your read?
Thinking about this as an academic, I like Alex's setup in that it prompts sort of exactly the right set of questions in my mind. And one set of questions is, what does it mean to say that the board is incapacitated or lacks capacity to process labor law claims such that the preemption regime, which is based on deference to the board, should be suspended? And so one poll of this theory would say, we have preemption unless the board is like absolutely eliminated. The president says, I'm not going to appoint anyone to the board for the duration of my term, and the board will have no quorum, and he fires all the ALJs. I'm making this up. Some extreme version of shutting down the board would give a pretty strong argument to states who want to say, without a board, there's no reason to have Garmin preemption. But then there are more sort of generous or robust or loose, or not loose is a bad word, robust versions of this theory, which would say, in order for Garmin preemption to make sense, the board actually has to be doing its job well. So the board has to be doing its job well means processing, under the California bill, processing ULPs in a certain amount of time. That's a more robust version of the theory than the one which says Garmin preemption stands unless the board is actually incapacitated by, let's say, a permanent lack of quorum. There is an interesting case out of the Fourth Circuit, which I'll just put on the table, very recent case out of the Fourth Circuit involving not the NLRA, but the Civil Service Act. Right. And the question in the Fourth Circuit case was, under what conditions does the Civil Service Act strip district courts of jurisdiction to hear federal employment claims? And what the Fourth Circuit said in that case is, normally the Civil Service Act strips district courts of jurisdiction, but that depends on the administrative apparatus of the act, which is the Merit Systems Review Board, operating the way, and this is the court's language, Congress intended. So that's an articulation of a theory about when the administrative apparatus of a statute is sufficiently active, engaged, functional to strip district courts of jurisdiction. By analogy, we might read that to mean that what we need for Garmin preemption to work, for Garmin preemption to function, is a National Labor Relations Board that is operating as Congress intended. Now, what that means would then be subject to debate.
Yes.
But it would mean something other than having a single member on the board who can't do anything. So my read of the California statute, of the Massachusetts statute, of the New York statute is that at you know, as I think about these things, at some level of abstraction or theory, they make good sense. They make good sense because Garmin preemption is about deference to the board. And Garmin preemption doesn't make sense if the board is not operating. Now, what it means for the board not to be operating is different according to different versions of these different statutes. But the basic idea of states can step in when the board is incapacitated makes good sense to me for Garmin preemption. I think we could talk about machinist preemption also, but I don't want to unduly complicate an already complicated picture.
No, that Professor Sachs, that's excellent table setting. Alex, quickly on the New York and Massachusetts statutes, then I want to get into the policy and legal ramifications.
Yeah, sure. The New York and Massachusetts statutes are a little easier to describe because they're a little more modest. The New York law is the shortest of the bills, but maybe the least clear. So what the New York statute does is it carves out employees from coverage under the New York law when the NLRB, so the New York has its own version of the NLRA, and it carves out employees currently when they're subject to the jurisdiction of the NLRA. What this law would change is that it would carve out those employees from New York's coverage when the NLRB successfully asserts jurisdiction over the employees. Whatever that means, though the language of the statute does seem to presuppose or envision that for the board to successfully assert jurisdiction, there has to be an order from an Article III court recognizing that the board has successfully asserted jurisdiction over this particular group of employees. So just on its face, the statute seems to say that unless there is a court decision saying that the board has in fact exercised jurisdiction over a particular group of employees, the New York agency will have authority over those employees and New York law will apply. That's also, I mean, that raises many of the same questions we're already talking about at Garmin preemption. It's a little less explicit and perhaps a little less, more elliptical than the way California has approached the issue. But I think just for the purposes of this discussion, we can sort of treat these two statutes as raising basically the same questions under Garmin.
I totally agree. Can I add one thought on that, Alex?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I agree that the New York statute, the wording is can be confusing. I read it as sort of flipping the default, which is to say that under this New York bill, the Public Employee Relations Board is going to have jurisdiction over private sector workers unless the NLRB asserts jurisdiction successfully, meaning gets a district court order confirming the NLRB's jurisdiction. So I think it's subject to debate, but it may be an interesting default flipping kind of assertion of state authority there.
I think that's a good way to put it. Totally agree.
Let's round out the table set. Massachusetts, Alex?
Yeah, Massachusetts. Massachusetts actually, as I read it, is really, it's a trigger law. And so what it says is that the state law will apply in three circumstances. One, the National Labor Relations Board has declined jurisdiction. Two, the board has determined that a profession or an industry or a trade is outside the act. Or three, federal law ceases to preempt state law. This is not so different from what we saw in many states in the abortion context. Many states had what they call trigger laws, where if Roe v. Wade was ever overturned, then abortion would become illegal in those states. This is kind of like that. It's saying that if federal preemption law ever changes, or for some reason there is a recognition that federal law is no longer preempting state law over labor relations, the Massachusetts law will kick in and the Massachusetts agency will take jurisdiction. I think that's the least adventurous of the three, because by its own terms, it doesn't necessarily apply if you have a functioning board, whatever that means, or traditional preemption doctrine in place. The law would basically sit on the books and not function until something changed. So in descending order of controversy, I think we can take California, New York, Massachusetts.
Don't dispute that. Professor Sachs, any comment on Massachusetts before we proceed?
No, that's great.
Okay. All right. Well, we've had lack of quorum issues for decades at the board on and off. The Supreme Court's decision in New Process Steel delineated what a quorum requirement is for the board to officially transact business. Well, why is today any different? The reason I asked the question at the outset, the quorum issue seems to be driving a good part of this discussion in the states and in other quarters. What's different about today compared to a lack of quorum in the past? Ben, let's start with you.
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's a hard question and an important one. So in some ways, what's different, it seems to me, is, and this I suppose this was more true last week than it is this week, but there was a sense that the end of the lack of quorum may not have come during this presidential administration. That is to say, there was a thought that perhaps the president's intent was to leave the board permanently as long as he was president without a quorum. And so that the what in the past had been, obviously temporary, even though there were extended periods of time, there was a thought that maybe this was going to be more of a permanent situation. Another way to think about your question, though, is, what does it mean for the theory that Garmin preemption is suspended when there's not a quorum, that there now will soon be a quorum? And I think there are two ways to think about that question, two ways to think about an answer to that question. One is, when there's no quorum, there's no preemption. And that when there's no quorum, states have the authority to act. And that when the quorum is restored, the states lose their ability to act again. That raises all kinds of practical questions, and that may be a bad system, but that's one way to think about the question. Another way to think about the question, or an answer to the question, is the fact that quorums come and go mean that there's something wrong with the theory that Garmin preemption is suspended when there's no quorum. That it's a bad theory because quorums can come and go. That's also a plausible answer to me. Let me just layer one other piece on top of this, which is part of the threat to the board in the current climate, it was and continues to be the lack of quorum. But there are other threats to the board. And those other threats are coming in the form of constitutional litigation that's being lodged by multiple corporations in multiple jurisdictions and seeing success in courts in the Fifth Circuit. And those are also attacks on the continuing viability of the board that are different than quorum, but might also provide a reason at the end of the day why Garmin preemption is in trouble. That is to say, if a court of appeals or ultimately the Supreme Court decides that the board as currently constituted, let's say the double insulation of the ALJs, is a constitutional problem and enjoins operation of the board on that basis, that would give us another reason, totally apart from quorum, for saying that Garmin preemption is in trouble.
Yeah, totally concur. I want to layer on top of that the Wilcox litigation and the partisan interference with board members' continuation of their term. And I'm going to layer on top of that the constant changing of board law and the lack of predictability. And we could layer a couple more on top of that. But before we get to those layers, Alex, how do you respond to my question? What's different today about a lack of a quorum? We've had that in the past.
I think the answer to your question is it's not different. And it can't be different practically, because to say that the idea is like, well, we think this situation may be permanent, that for whatever reason, we don't think there's going to be nominees coming, we don't think anybody's going to be confirmed, suggests that there is some qualitative difference. At some point, you can flip the light switch and say, well, you know, this vacancy was temporary and we were just working through the normal political process to get a nominee confirmed, whereas this other vacancy is permanent or intentional or strategic. And to make that kind of distinction, what you have to do is peer into the minds of a bunch of the people that are making these decisions and say, well, you know, obviously they're withholding nominees in this instance, or they have no plans to submit nominees in this other instance, which seems to me wildly impractical to ask a court to do. I compare this a little bit to some of the litigation over former deputy acting secretary of labor, Julie Hsu. There were a few cases where claimants argued that Ms. Hsu couldn't continue to operate or run the Department of Labor because even though the statute allowed her to operate while the secretary seat was vacant, the administration had no plans to nominate or had not moved to nominate a permanent replacement. It's just a very difficult analysis for a court to conduct and figure out where you cross the line from a normal vacancy to an extraordinary vacancy. But the other thing, and it's just as a from a conceptual standpoint, the difficulty I have with the premise behind some of these state laws that Garmin preemption can turn on and off depending on whether the board is functioning in our view or not, is ultimately preemption is it's a matter of congressional intent. But when we think of, did Congress really want to displace federal law, or excuse me, state law in this instance with a federal scheme? And the NLRA doesn't actually have an express preemption provision, so we can't point to that provision and say, oh, this is the instance when Congress wanted to preempt state laws. What we have to look at is this broad purpose of the NLRA, this whole idea about a national labor system. It's implied within the statute as opposed to explicit. But the things we do know explicitly about Congress's system, the system Congress did set up, was that it does have a quorum requirement. The quorum requirement is part of the scheme that Congress enacted. So it's odd to say that the scheme that Congress enacted is not functioning when the board drops below a quorum and can't exercise its functions. That was inherent in the features of the NLRA as created by Congress. It's also the other problem with the intent piece is we do know that Congress knows how to allow states to regulate. It did it twice in the NLRA. Section 10A allows the NLRB to enter into agreements with state agencies to handle some matters under the NLRA. Section 14C allows states to regulate when the board expressly declines jurisdiction. 14C was added to the statute after the Supreme Court held that states could not operate or regulate when the board had declined jurisdiction. It was this case called Gus v. Utah Labor Relations Board. The court basically said, yeah, you're right. If the board declines jurisdiction and states are preempted, it creates this no man's land where nobody can assert their labor rights. And the court said, that's true, and it's also part of the statute of the system that Congress set up. So Congress acted, it came in and said, all right, if the board in this situation expressly declines jurisdiction, states can step in. So we know explicitly the situations where Congress wanted the preemption to turn off like a light. Then that's not the situation we have under the California law, or as I read it, the New York law. I think it might be the situation we have under the Massachusetts law. But so there's just a to me, a practical and a conceptual problem with proceeding on the view that if we fall below the three-member quorum, something happens to Garmin, it evaporates.
So yeah. I want to agree that there are practical and conceptual difficulties with this question and theory, but I want to respond in two ways. One, I agree with Alex when he says it's very difficult to distinguish between a temporary quorum, temporary lack of quorum, and a permanent lack of quorum. That difficulty, though, surrendering to that difficulty means that a president could say, I intend not to nominate anyone to the board, and I intend to deprive the board of a quorum for 4 years. And then you would have an inoperative board for 4 years and nothing that could be done about it. It seems to me that in light of that, there ought to be some way to relax Garmin's rules, because Garmin is about deference to the administrative capacity of the board. I think it's really difficult to figure out how to distinguish a temporary lack of quorum from what we're calling a permanent one, which that's a misnomer, but how to distinguish these various kinds of lack of quorum. But I don't think we should give up. I also agree that the touchstone here is, and always is, congressional intent. I think to the extent that the theory has legs, it depends on the idea, and this is also very much what animates the Fourth Circuit opinion in the Owen case that I mentioned, that Congress intended there to be a functioning board, and that the Supreme Court built Garmin preemption around the idea that Congress intended there to be a functioning board. Again, really difficult to figure out what functioning and not functioning means, but that at some point, if we don't have a functioning board, we don't have the congressional intent to preempt state law with respect to Garmin preemption. That what Congress intended was there to be a functioning board to carry out labor law. That's what gave the Supreme Court license to create the Garmin rule. And without the functioning board, we don't have that congressional intent to preempt. This is not to minimize the very difficult questions about what's functional, what's a lack of quorum. All those things are very real. But to me, at bottom, the idea that you can have a preemption doctrine built around the deference to the administrative capacity of a board that exists and continues to run without a functioning board is wrong.
So let me get into my next layer. If the Supreme Court in Wilcox litigation ultimately upholds a chief executive's right to preemptively remove a board member without cause, does that also undermine Garmin and machinists, i.e. a chief executive of any party can either eliminate a quorum or replace a board member at will? Does that suggest that the board is no longer a neutral adjudicative agency capable of functioning? Ben, how do you react to that?
Yeah, I take the question. I totally get it. I think it's another really hard, excellent question. I don't think there's a clear answer. I mean, maybe the way I would answer it would be to say, I think one can read the Fourth Circuit opinion in Owen as suggesting that what matters is that the administrative agency in question be functioning as Congress intended. And that one way to understand as Congress intended would be independent from the president. And so if you put those two pieces together, and I think maybe this is what you're suggesting, Roger, you come up with a theory that without independence, the board isn't functioning as Congress intended and therefore isn't entitled to the preemptive deference that the court gave it in Garmin. That is a very robust version of this theory. Let me just leave it at that. It's a very robust right. version of the theory right. And is very different than the theory which says without a quorum or if the board is struck down as a matter of constitutional law, then Garmin is suspended. Those are very different versions of the theory.
I agree. I want to move to a couple of nuances on that question. Alex, your response to my question?
No, it's a good question. I think these are related issues, but distinct and ought to be treated distinctly. Though it does relate to some of the discussion we were having earlier about the constitutional challenges to the board structure, how that relates to preemption, I think it matters what we mean when we say the board is quote unquote unconstitutional, as often it gets sort of portrayed in the press. You have to remember, the two main theories behind a lot of this litigation have been A, that the board's administrative law judges are improperly insulated from presidential control. It has a tenuous connection to whether the NLRA at all functions. You could imagine that the remedy in that case would merely be to remove one of the layers of insulation that the NLA or the ALJs enjoy. And that doesn't really seem to implicate the preemptive scope of the board. The other theory behind some of these cases is that the board members themselves are improperly insulated from control. This is the same issue that's at the heart of the Wilcox case. Does the board qualify for a exception to the general rule that the president can remove the principal officer of the United States? There's an old case from the 1930s called Humphrey's Executor. Again, that's an entirely different webinar that we could get into. But ultimately, again, if the answer is that those removal protections are unconstitutional, which the president has taken the position and has been teed up in the Wilcox case, that also doesn't necessarily seem to implicate whether or not the NLRA itself as a statute, as a national scheme, has preemptive effect on state agencies. What it could mean is that you would have faster turnover in the board's personnel, but it doesn't necessarily decide one way or another this question that we're having about preemption, which I actually just want to say, I agree with Professor Sachs that as a policy matter, you can make a really good case that we ought to have more competitive federalism in our labor system, that states ought to be able to experiment with different schemes. Maybe Texas wants an entirely different Texas labor law than California does. And maybe that would be good as a practical matter. I just have a difficulty constructing it out of the statute that we have today, which itself, if you're just looking for congressional intent, does include this quorum requirement and does include specific mechanisms for delegating to this authority to the states, none of which include just the mere loss of a quorum. I don't know if that answers your question, Roger.
No. It gets to the edge of the question. And of course, we also have critics of the board pointing out that the board doesn't process its agenda, doesn't process its case agenda in a timely fashion. And you put on top of that the constitutional questions. But I don't want to deviate really from what we are here today to discuss, and that's preemption. And I think, been around that question as we've had our discussion. But put aside where we are with the board today, isn't it sound policy for this country to have a federal labor law system that does preempt, to use your word, Alex, experiments into this area and provide uniformity for all stakeholders, whether it be union, employers, employees? And hasn't the preemption doctrine, however one defines that, served this country well in meeting the objectives of the Wagner Act, i.e. decreasing instability, decreasing conflict in the workplace, providing for a free flow of commerce? Isn't that a desirable objective? And Ben, quickly, and then Alex, then I want to follow that up with a couple related questions.
Yeah, I mean, so now I want to point, just like say that you're asking an entirely different kind of question, which is, you know, really, I mean, it couldn't be more important, but is much more about labor policy than labor preemption doctrine. You know, to try to answer quickly, I guess what I would say is optimally, we do want a federal system of labor law. Absolutely. But I think the question that we face today is whether a dysfunctional federal system is better than a 50-state policy approach. And, you know, so what do I mean by dysfunctional? Here we'll have probably deeper disagreement. But, you know, in a nutshell, you know, if as I do, we take a primary goal of the federal labor law, ensuring employees a free choice on the union question, I'm not sure we have that. And given that, I'm worried about preemption, because then what you have is a federal law that doesn't work, but also stops states from experimenting. And so my concern is that that's the world we're living in. And given that, although a better federal system is optimal, it may be that a second best solution is state experimentation rather than federal dysfunction and state incapacity.
Yeah, fair enough. Excellent answer. But as I
posed,
Alex, I just want to make one comment. So I think one response to that state experimental system is, what's an Alabama LRB going to look like? What's a Mississippi LRB going to look like? And Alex, this is a segue into, I think, a phrase that you coined, a competitive entrepreneurial federalism, or where we have one state proceeding in one direction and other states proceeding in a different direction. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please proceed.
No, of course, it was a good point. I think what Professor Sachs just said really gets to the nub of this entire debate, which is dysfunction. Dysfunction is in the eye of the beholder. Right? There are many people who in good faith believe that federal law is not functioning because we have record low unionization rates. We have first contracts that take years to negotiate. We have in the private sector, we have a lower union density than we had before the Wagner Act passed. These have all been subjects of concern in many corners of our community. But there are other people who believe that federal law is functioning exactly as it should. I will put my cards on the table. I believe I am one of these people, because one of the main goals of federal law from the origins was to ensure labor peace, that we have a peaceful industrial system. We are not riven by industrial strife. And today we don't have industrial strife. We have historically low levels of major work stoppages in this country. And so if you take the premise that labor law was intended to reduce the disruption that ordinary people face in the market as a result of things like the Pullman strikes, then labor law appears to be functioning pretty well. Though if you take it and that was one of the two major premises of the Wagner Act. Wagner Act's other major premise was that it wanted to ensure what the drafters called full freedom of contract, with what they meant was balancing bargaining power. And if you look at labor law through that prism, then you may say, well, given low union densities, federal labor policy is not working. And so this comes down to what you believe the purpose of labor law is in the modern. Is it the first Wagner Act premise or is it the second Wagner Act premise? That's a debate people can have, but that is the nub of this question. Should we have a broad preemptive doctrine to ensure that federal law continues to function as some of us think it is properly functioning, or is the preemptive effect a problem because what it results in is low union densities? That's where this debate gets teed up, and that's why you have such vigorous disagreement and why you have things like AB 288, which are proposing to radically remake the system.
Well, the issue of federalism and preemption, I think, are intertwined. I was 99% through with an extensive paper on preemption in the labor law arena until the last 4 months in California, New York, and Massachusetts disrupted my entire paper. But let me suggest this. If you go back to the Federalist Papers and exchanges by our founders, I believe it's clear that they intended to have a strong federal system of government with certain exceptions. And it appears to me that federal preemption fits that strong central government uniformity, and that it is the intent of Congress that the Garmin preemption picks up to have that federal strong system of government, particularly in this area of labor and employment. The alternative of having 50 colonies with their own version of federal labor law suggests to me a disruptive environment leading to all kinds of legal problems. But Ben, you've mentioned a couple of times practical problems, and I want to get into that before we close our session today. If California precedes New York, Massachusetts, we're going to have litigation. But in the interim, employers, unions, and employees are caught in this ambiguity area. And do you go back if ultimately a preemption challenge is upheld and undo what California did or what Massachusetts did? How do you respond on a day-to-day basis while these state laws may be in effect, while we have this debate that we're discussing today, or this discussion, at least on preemption? How does that work? It seems to me just it invites a great deal of practical problems. Ben, you, and then Alex.
Yeah, so I want to mainly just agree that this, you've identified one of many sort of untested and practical difficulties with the system that we're imagining. You know, it seems to me that if a union is certified under state law and bargains a collective agreement, and the state law is later deemed to be preempted, that the contract would remain in force and the certification would remain in force. But then, you know, when it comes time to recertify the union, or if there's a decertification challenge, or if the contract expires, then you have a different set of questions. But that would be my basic approach.
Understood. Alex, your thought?
I don't actually know how you untangle the practical problems. I mean, I just think about how this would play out in reality. I mean, imagine when these disputes hit the courts, right? I mean, is a court, you know, let's say you're a federal district court sitting in the Northern District of California, and it's a decision of the PERB comes before you, and the PERB has done something that is in a jurisdiction or in a industry that is normally covered by national labor law, and the California board has ordered one of the parties to do something that is inconsistent with national law but consistent with California law, where your federal district court sitting there, you have the NLRA on the books, regardless of whether there's a quorum. What law are you supposed to apply? I don't know. If what we're saying is that Garmin has turned off and there's no longer a preemptive effect, I'm not sure there is a good answer to that question. I certainly don't have a good answer to it. And I don't think I haven't seen anybody offer a good answer for what a court is supposed to do in that case. So I just don't know how you untangle it. And I'm afraid that if these laws go forward, we're going to, you know, have a lot of chaos to untangle that's going to be very expensive for the people involved to work their way through it. You know, it would be much better if we had a stable system that works the way it has worked for nearly 100 years. But I don't think we're going to be living in that reality for the next couple of years. It seems like there are interests involved that are determined to change the status quo, and I think that will be messy.
Now, I think legally and practically, we're going to have serious questions. Does it make any difference that the National Labor Relations Board itself as an institution has remained silent to date on these various challenges to federal preemption and federal labor law? I mean, we certainly have the quorum issue that we've discussed, but even before the quorum issue became such a front and center point, we had states enacting statutes that restricted employer speech in so-called captive audience meetings. And there have been many other state and local challenges in the labor law area, but we've had at least over the last 4 years plus total silence from the institution itself. The former general counsel did not file one challenge to any of these statutes. The current acting general counsel has yet to speak on this issue. Does that matter at all in this discussion? Ben?
I would assume that a court would be very interested in knowing the agency's views on this question. But I don't think it makes sense to let the agency decide the scope of the preemptive effect of the statute that it administers. As Alex was saying, those are questions that courts resolve according to, their view of congressional intent. The board might have insight into that, but it's not a matter of agency discretion.
Yeah, fair enough.
Seems to
Alex?
Me.
Yeah, no, I take the point, Roger. And ultimately, I mean, preemption doctrine is a matter of law. Of course, going to have to decide that. I agree with all of that. The board does and has in prior cases brought these types of challenges. I recall there was a case in 2016. Peter Robb brought a challenge to a state, I believe it was a state law involving regulation of marijuana dispensaries. So this can happen. And the agency does have authority to bring these cases in front of a court, which will ultimately make the decision. So it's not necessarily the board's view of the issue. It is a court's, but the agency has a role to play and has played that role on occasion. But I don't know that the agency's intervention is necessary to resolve this issue. I think it can be resolved by courts absent the board's affirmative intervention, and they're going to have to if these laws go forward. And I also from a practical standpoint, given the quorum situation and given that we only have an acting the general counsel, it seems to me unlikely that we're going to see the board weigh in on some of these issues. Now, you mentioned captive audiences. That could be its own webinar as well. I think some of the hesitancy there may be that there was a difference of views within the board itself for several years about whether those types of meetings were in fact protected or prohibited under the NLRA. We now have an answer from the board, which is being challenged in court. But I would have been shocked if the former general counsel brought that challenge in court while that issue was pending with the board.
All right. Well, let's close this out. I want to pose this question and summarize your thoughts in response to what we've been talking about today. The president now has nominated two individuals for two of the vacancies on the board. Assume regular order by the Senate, and these two individuals are confirmed. Does that moot out our discussion today? And/or does preemption have a longer lifespan than maybe we've been suggesting today? Ben, let's start with you, and then Alex.
Yeah, so I don't think it moots out the discussion because I think these are really interesting topics that go sort of to the heart of preemption and what we mean by whether we want a national system of labor law. I guess one theory is when quorum is restored, then Garmin preemption reactivates. But we've had a period, whether we knew it or not, when Garmin preemption was not operative. Another theory is that the whole thing was a mistake, and the restoring of a quorum just shows that this was all temporary, and there was no reason to have the discussion at all. I think that the fact is that there are multiple threats to the capacity of the board. One is the quorum. The others are the constitutional challenges to the board, to the ALJs, to the constitutionality of the statute, and that it's worth figuring out what the effect of any of those attacks, if successful, would be on the viability of Garmin preemption. So I'm glad to have this conversation, and I take a lot away from the last hour.
Well, Ben, we will continue to have the discussion, and thank you so much. Alex, your thoughts on my question and summarize where we are?
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree. This, assuming regular order and assuming that the nominees are duly confirmed in a relatively expeditious process, I still don't think this moves out the discussion, because this is not the last time we're going to lack a quorum on the NLRB. And these three laws we've been talking about today are not the only laws that challenge the scope of Garmin preemption. We've touched on a few already just in the last call. The captive audience bills are a good example. Preemption is going to continue to be an issue in the courts. And the next time we have a board member roll off and we fall to two, what does that mean for some of these laws that seem on their face to tread into territory that is regulated by federal labor law? These are questions we're going to have to continue to confront, and maybe for, you know, years we're going to be talking about this. So regardless of whether we have a temporary or current quorum, the issue is not going to go away.
Well, it just occurs to me that preemption and labor policy are so intertwined, and we need to have continuing discussion about what our labor policy is in this country. And preemption certainly is an important part of that discussion. I meant what I said at the beginning. I think the labor relations climate in this country is so unstable, and we do need a more stable environment, in my opinion, at the federal level, but we shall discuss that. And is the board dead? Well, I think many may come to that conclusion. We'll see how the Wilcox litigation proceeds. And to give a advertisement for another FedSoc webinar, Professor Sam Estreicher, Professor David Sherwin, and myself are going to strongly, hopefully, convince you that we need an Article I labor court to settle some of these discussions. Thank you, Professor Sachs. Excellent, excellent discussion. Alex, thank you also. And we will continue this discussion, I'm sure, in the future. And thanks
for thank you, Roger.
Well, you're absolutely welcome. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for all the attendees and those that will listen to this on a recording basis. We are now concluded.
On the behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Alex and Professor Sachs for speaking with us today, and to Roger for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org. We're on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.